Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Chrysler. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 292 for June 19th of 2015. Designing sex in the surfaces of the Ford GT. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. All right, After Hours, Gary Vasilash.
How are you doing, John?
I'm doing pretty good.
Well, this is 2 weeks in a row. Of course, you were a guest last week.
So I know. I guess, that's right.
Yeah. So now you're in the chair. So.
Yep. Now I'm sitting here, and we got to tell everybody we got Todd Lasa from Automobile Magazine with us too.
So, hi, Todd, John.
Great seeing you.
Great to see you too.
But then, of course, we got Craig Metros, the head of all exterior design for Ford of the Americas, and Craig, it's awesome to have you here in the studio with
us. Great to be here.
And we'll get into a whole bunch of things, but I want to start right out with the Ford GT because that came out of your effort, right? Now, did you design the thing or you oversaw the design or how did that work?
I actually came late to the party. I've spent the last almost 9 years in Australia, and I just came back to this new position last year. And so I caught the tail end. So the architecture was pretty much set. I did have inputs on the final surfacing, a lot of the details, the graphics. But yeah, what an amazing project to come back to.
So explain what that all means in terms of, okay, the architecture set, but then you added these things. So for the viewers who are
When I say architecture, the package, you know, we knew that it's a carbon fiber tub design, and so the car's based around that. A lot of aero inputs into the car, a lot of wind tunnel testing went in. The tunneling of the car, separating the fuselage from the rear fenders, a lot of that was sort of a combination of design and wind tunnel studies. So a lot of those parameters were set. When I arrived to the program, we were still doing a lot of surface tuning and tweaking. The car was looking very rigid and a lot of flat surfaces just coming out of the tunnel. So we were, it was that fine line between, you know, something extremely functional aerodynamically, but also, you know, we wanted something to look very, you know, beautiful and also something that a car that captured the essence of the original GT. We knew from day one that this car was all about technology and developing a race car. So it was always about moving forward, but we also, at the end of the day, wanted to make sure when people saw it, they recognized it as a Ford GT.
Craig, auto journalists are guilty of always saying that, you know, kind of parroting what PR says, that so-and-so is the designer of car A or car B, and you mentioned that you kind of came in a little bit late. Could you talk a little bit about the team who worked on this? You can name names if you want.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Murray Callum, he's the vice president of design. Chris Svensson was heavily involved. He's the design director for the Americas. I think he was on this show.
Maybe, yes, he was. Yeah.
About a year and a half ago. He was involved. And then we had myself, I was involved. And then Todd Willing was another design chief. He's the one that replaced my position in Australia, so we did a swap. But then we had, so those were, that was the, what I would call the experience in the team. And then we had a couple of guys right out of school, some very young, gifted designers that actually had a lot to do with what I call pinning the car, you know, which, I mean, I'm not sketching anymore. Maury's not sketching anymore, but the young guys are the ones that are coming up with the ideas, putting them on a board, and we're, you know, basically going through and picking them.
So how does it work from the very, very beginning of an effort like this? I mean, do the engineers figure out, okay, we want, you know, this rear mid engine, we want the carbon fiber tub, we want this and that and the other thing. So here, you designers, package the whole thing. Or do the designers start out by going, hey, wouldn't this look cool? Now you engineers figure out how to package everything in there.
I think it depends on the program. Because this was from day one, you know, we wanted to do a race car. We had a lot of inputs from, you know, the engineering team that you know, basically know how to put together a race car. So day one, it was always a midship car. I think working hand in hand with the engineers, because of the EcoBoost motor, the V6, it's physically a pretty tight motor. So we were able to start experimenting with the package of that motor, and that's something that design did. We started to really sort of wrap the envelope in the rear area, and that's where we started experimenting of divorcing the fuselage from the fenders and ended up with these separate fender pods and eventually gave way to the flying buttresses.
Which are way cool.
They're very cool, aren't they? The plan view of the car is my favorite view. It's extremely stunning, and it looks like a jet fighter.
And for those who don't know, plan view is looking directly overhead.
Straight down overhead at the car. Yeah.
So you said you wanted it to be heir to the original car. What about the one in between?
The one in between, the 05 car, that car, it was never, I know, you know, it's been raced. You know, a lot of people take that car to the track. It, you know, it's a great performer, but that car was never, built as a, you know, we're going to build a race car, we're going to Le Mans. That was more of a, really an aesthetic tribute to the original car. You know, we were celebrating our 100th anniversary at the time. I believe we did a show car at that time and announced it that we would build it. So it was really to honor and pay tribute to that car. This car, really, when you analyze it, really is quite closer as a program to the original car, where the original one was meant to race. You know, we were experimenting with materials and technologies, and that's what, you know, the 16 car is all about.
Is there anything beside the midship engine that you would point to that kind of comes from the original car that you decided you wanted to or had to have? Obviously, this car, it's designed to be fast. It's designed to be a race car first, so the design elements kind of play second fiddle to what works on the racetrack.
I mean, you know, once the car was doing well in the tunnel, we worked back and forth with engineering to just get the right amount of curvature over the front and rear fenders. The original car had that very signature haunch to the rear, which is something we wanted. It also has this sort of almost the de-accelerating silhouette line toward the rear that we thought was quintessential for GT. Shape of the headlamps, the vents in the front surface area. Again, they're very recognizable Ford GT. The round taillights, but, you know, executed in a much more modern way.
Yeah, to me it's interesting that, you know, it's completely different from the original car or the 05 car.
Yeah.
And yet when I look at least from the front end, head on, I go, that's a GT.
Yeah.
There's no question whatsoever.
The 05, you know, when you look at it, it's a cleaned up version of the original. Where this one, you know, people ask, well, what, you know, wow, you know, we thought you'd do another, you know, car that paid tribute. You know, why would you do that? You know,
Camilo Pardo was sitting in that very chair here earlier this year, and he's saying that much the same of what you said. The 05 car was a look back, a tribute to the, and he says, I hope the new car looks forward.
Yeah.
And that's what you've absolutely done, at least the way I see it.
Yeah, I mean, Murray Kellum sums it up quite well. He always talks about the 05 car gave way to this car. You know, after we looked back, we paid tribute. Now it was time to move forward and actually, you know, go back to racing.
Well, and the 05 car was a very good-looking street car. At the Geneva Auto Show, Ford showed one of the original, fewer than 50, I think, road cars based on the 65-66 race car. And it didn't look quite so pretty. It didn't translate into the street regulations that they needed back then quite so well. It was just take the race car and make it...
some amenities in it.
Make it work as a road car. So let me ask you, though, and this question comes from my old colleague, Frank Marcus, who wonders about the air intake. You've got the radiators on the side like mm-hmm. that. He wonders whether for street use, whether you're going to get enough air to the turbos in time to prevent lag. I'm not saying that quite as elegantly as Frank would ask the question, but can you talk about that at all?
That's a very technical question. I mean, I not being an engineer, I would imagine it depends on how fast you're going.
Which is why it'll work as a race car,
right?
As he points out. Yeah.
Right. I think was it race car first, though? I mean, that was your goal, right?
The aerodynamically, it was. You know, obviously, we showed the road car first at Detroit. We were, you know, basically designing them at the same time. And we, though it was a race car, I guess from a design standpoint, we, you know, unlike the original car, we wanted to make sure that, you know, the car looks great, whether it's on the track or on the road. So that's why we, you know, we constantly work back and forth. But, you know, there's not a ton of changes on the, you know, there's some lower mods, some aero mods, obviously the larger wing. But it's, you know, a lot of the surfaces are very similar.
And I think we should point out, for those who don't know, the flying buttress that goes from the rear fenders right into the roof are not only bringing in air for the radiators right in front of the rear wings, but that's the conduit to get air into the engine. Mm-hmm. Hence Frank's question.
Exactly, yeah. Can you
get enough air into the engine? But a lot of people don't realize that those flying buttresses are actually quite functional from an aerodynamic and an air induction standpoint.
Right.
Craig, did you guys, when you were developing this car, I mean, it wasn't all about saying, oh, look at the old, look at the GT40, now we'll look at the 05. I mean, what else were you guys looking at in the world when you were developing this car?
We were looking at the competition. We were looking at, you know, world-class supercars. We were looking at, you know, Le Mans race cars. We, you know, again, because we were looking forward, you know, we weren't really looking at the original cars. It was all about really moving forward. But, again, just making sure that, you know, we didn't want something that looked, you know, something too radical that you just didn't recognize as a Ford or a GT. We definitely wanted a car to look like a Ford GT.
If you go to the 05 car, inside, it's pretty plain. I mean, it almost looks like they didn't spend a whole lot of money on it.
Yeah.
If you look at the new car, looks like you guys spent as much time designing, if you will, the interior, the exterior.
Yeah, I guess I would describe the interior as extremely fit for purpose. I mean, it's devoid of a lot of trim, and even compared to the 05 car, it's very serious. It's the instrumentation exactly is right where it needs to be. It's quite tight. We've pulled the H points together because if you look at the plan view of that fuselage, it really shrink wraps the, you know, not only the people package, but the engine package as well. So it is a tight package, but it you definitely feel like you're in a race car when you're sitting in it, in terms of just the amount of space and just how functional and fit for purpose everything is and where it's placed. The steering wheel is fantastic. The steering wheel is it's right out of a race car. Everything is right at your fingertips on the actual hub.
Well, remind us, what kind of, I hate to use this word, infotainment system does it have? To your point about it being very purpose-built, it'll be an expensive car, but it won't necessarily have all the latest convenience gadgets, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it'll have touchscreen, it'll have sync, it'll have a lot of the attributes that we have in cars today, but just the way that everything is placed, it'll have air conditioning, mm-hmm. it'll have all the options,
sure.
but, things like just the materials in the seat, everything was done for lightening the car. It won't come with leather. You know, it doesn't have, there's basically really no added trim to the interior. Door trim panels are, there's a lot of carbon fiber coming through. The carbon fiber tub is the actual raw carbon fiber. It's literally the structure of the car, and then we've literally laid in the seat cushions in that pod. So the steering wheel and the pedals move to the driver. The seat isn't, it's not on a track. It doesn't move like a conventional car.
When you have the car in the studio, are there learnings that can be taken from the GT and applied to products that you guys may be developing for the future?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the car is all carbon fiber, so we've learned a lot about that material and what it can do. Us as designers, we love it because we feel like it's really, I mean, it's not only functional, it's really lightened the car, very rigid, very strong material, but it's really allowed us to create some of the extreme shapes that we probably never would have been able to create in sheet metal or aluminum. So, we were even wondering, you probably couldn't have done this car in 66, let alone even maybe even an 05. So again, it's allowed us to really push the envelope with the shape and the sculpture of the car.
So you couldn't have done it because of the change in materials and processing, or?
Yeah, when you walk up to the car and look at the body side sections, the topography is quite extreme.
Understatement of the year.
Yeah, and just, the depth of draw. You know, if you had to do conventional tooling, you wouldn't get there. You mm-hmm. wouldn't get that amount of.
It'd all have to be hand fabricated with
yeah.
multiple pieces.
Yeah,
it would. So you were over at Le Mans when Ford made the official announcement. Bill Ford Jr., chairman of the company, started the race, with the wave
yep.
of the green flag.
Yep.
But what I'm curious about was, what was the public's reaction to Ford going back and making this announcement that it's going to race the GT?
It was crazy. It was so exciting to be there. It was very reminiscent of being in Detroit when, we debuted the car. It was that sort of reaction. But what was interesting about it is you meet so many people from around the world. To take the car to Le Mans, there's so much history with that car. It's such a iconic nameplate for the company, and Le Mans is such a special place for us. So it was, to experience that, it was extremely special. It was definitely a career highlight. We were talking earlier, and people were just, the car was displayed inside of the Ford facility there was a front glass wall, and all weekend long, people are up pressed against the glass trying to catch a glimpse of the car. And then I even stayed when they were taking down the facility and they were taking the car out onto a trailer, and they had to rope off the area to get the car in the trailer because they just wanted to catch a glimpse of the car. So yeah, it was very popular.
That's really
very
cool.
Exciting to experience.
So wait until you come back next year.
Oh, I know.
To put,
yeah.
I think there's going to be, what, four that will be entered in the race?
I'm not sure.
Two for sure, but I think maybe
sure,
four.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the exact number is.
And the specific class for this car is, help me out, because I always have trouble keeping the Le Mans classes straight, is...
GTE Pro.
GTE Pro.
I mean, there's a Pro and an Am being amateur, although these amateur drivers are awfully damn good.
Yeah.
They're not full-time race drivers.
Right.
But there's four categories. There's, you know, P1, the full-blown ones. Maybe we'll talk more about that later. P2 and GTE Pro, which is what Corvette won.
Yes.
And GTE Am, which I guess it was a Ferrari 458. And, in fact, Patrick Dempsey, famous, you know, movie and television actor, I think he was on the podium. I think he took second in GTE Am. In a 911, I think it was. So, well, we're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back, and we got a whole lot more questions for Craig Metros here, including from you in the audience.
Any chance I can grab one?
We're back with Craig Metros talking about the Ford GT. We could probably talk design all day long, too, but this is such a hot topic. Armin wants to know, does the fixed seating position have any effect on styling?
Not on this car, it didn't. No, I mean, it would, you know, I mean, maybe it would affect, I guess, the silhouette, but, you know, we never had an issue with it.
He wants to know, too, what's your favorite feature on the GT?
Oh, favorite feature. There's too many.
No.
I would say probably the flying buttresses, the plan view, the direct overview of the vehicle. It's my favorite.
And Pizzazz is Good wants to know, how much, if anything, is expected to change on the production version versus the show car?
The show car was pretty much production surfaces, so... there's not going to be much changes.
I remember when I was with you at the Detroit show and Camillo Pardo was there and he said, gee, wait until they show the production version. And you said, that is the production version.
Yeah.
And he said something expletive. Couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
A.M. Guerrero, who writes in from Manila in the Philippines, wants to know, was integrating some Le Mans prototype style aerodynamics part of the original plan for the GT?
On this vehicle, on the 16?
Yeah, I think he means on the new one.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, we knew we wanted to go back to racing, so aerodynamics was a big part of the program from day one.
Vegan Dish 800 Cal wants to know if the GT will out-accelerate the Tesla, even though the Tesla fits 7 people plus and a fair amount of luggage.
I'm sure it will.
That's the right answer. Hey, we got a phone call here. Ben, let's bring that in.
Yes, my name is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, the new Ford GT, what class is it going to race in Le Mans? Since it's not a true production car, they're not going to make 30, 40, 50,000 or more every year. It's more or less a... you know, I'm sure they're going to make 20 or 30 a year, maybe more. But what class is it going to run? Is it going to run against the Corvettes, or is it going to run against the other more exotic type cars like the Lamborghinis and stuff? Thank you.
Clearly he just missed the answer. It's GTE Pro.
And I think he probably meant the more exotic cars like the Audis and the Porsches and the Toyotas in the P1, So was there ever any discussion about doing a car that would race
in the P1 class?
You know, I don't know. That was probably before my time.
I think I do have the answer to that, and it goes something like this. If you want to take on Porsche and Audi and LMP1, you better be ready to spend $300 million, if not $400 million.
Yeah.
That's what it takes to run up there.
Yeah.
And Ford was not willing to spend that kind of money. And besides, why bash your brains out against them? Why not earn your way up there? Why not come into the GTE Pro class and see what you can do? And to answer the question, that'll run against Corvettes, Aston Martins, Porsches, What else?
Ferraris.
Right. But I think a good question. Don't you have to homologate? You have to build a certain number to be able to run.
I think we wanted to relate it to, you know, the nameplate we already had, and also we wanted it to be accessible to people. We wanted it to be a road car where the P1s, they're experimental.
Track only. Yeah,
they're track only.
Right.
So we wanted something that people could go to a Ford dealership and purchase.
Not every Ford dealership, presumably.
Yeah. But you can. That's half the appeal, if not a lot, most of the appeal of these GTE classes is that they start life out as real cars that then get modified to be race cars.
Yeah,
There's not a whole lot of that left in the racing world.
It's certainly a much different world than 50 years ago when Ford decided to go up directly against Ferrari after that infamous snub and won outright after a couple of years. But you're right, it took a couple of years, and it was a much different world. Cost much less back then, and the cars were a lot different.
Yeah. David Pate says he'd be curious to know the drag coefficient and the downforce on the car.
God, I don't have the numbers.
I'm not even sure Ford's handing them out now anyway.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, they're very good. And there was always a balance between aerodynamics and downforce. I don't even know if we're announcing those numbers.
So aerodynamics, downforce, what about aesthetics?
Meaning,
did you say, well, you know, you might get a better count here, but that really looks awful?
Actually, the buttresses came from the designers, the guys that they're the ones that started on sketch form, you know, experimenting with this, really shrink wrapping the package and starting to divorce the fuselage from the fenders. So it was really working back and forth, and you know what? It was a great team effort because we knew that this car needs to perform. It's a race car. It's a functional product, but the engineers also knew that we want something very aesthetically pleasing. We wanted a sexy sports car, and they knew that. So it was really a great team effort, working back and forth with that balance of knowing that, this car is very fit for purpose. We're developing a race car. But at the end of the day, we wanted it needed to be emotional and something that people you see it and you just fall in love with it.
Well, and you mentioned that some of the surfaces were a little flatter when it came out of the, after it, came out of the wind tunnel, mm-hmm. So obviously that's when he played with it a little bit of a.
In the wind tunnel, we do a lot of simulation, a lot of digital simulation, but in the wind tunnel, it's a lot of movements in clay or in cardboard or whatever material, and they're quite crude, and you're after a sort of a direction or something that could possibly work from an aerodynamic standpoint or a downforce perspective. But then, getting those insights and that knowledge, bringing it back to the studio, then we gave it some love. We put the sex and the surfacing and the sensuality back into it.
Give us an example of that, because I'm not a designer. So it comes out of the wind tunnel, and you go, that looks flat.
Oh, just, the sections over the front fenders were a bit flat, and some of them just almost looked like they were going hollow. And just giving it the right amount of positive into a negative. It's very sculptural when you're in a wind tunnel working with engineers, they're just about getting the numbers. And we're always about, exactly what it looks like. And so, again, it was just that team effort of finding that finite balance.
So was it more about essentially designing with the hand versus designing with digital technology?
Not necessarily. We do both in the industry. But with the digital tools we have now, you'd be amazed at the amount of sensitivity we can get digitally. I mean, they've come a long way. Remember the tools, inputs are still being done by hand, right? But, maybe instead of going directly to the clay, we're doing it in CAD. And we do it this way just because of speed. It's so much faster to develop something in CAD, spend the day on it, get it right, rotate it, check the highlights, and then send it to the mill, mill it overnight. We come in the morning and there it is, mm-hmm. physically. It just really speeds up the process.
Sure, because it's so much easier to make any changes. Yeah. You can keep reiterating things.
And we still have hand modelers. We still, are constantly finessing things by hand. But it's pretty amazing that the tools we have today are, they're great. And again, it really speeds up the process for us.
Danny Boy from Cleveland says, hey, could you stick a wide V8 such as the Ford Coyote back there if you had to?
I probably not.
That's what I've heard, EcoBoost.
We really narrowed the back of that fuselage up. I think a V8 would probably be poking out of the carbon fiber panels a bit.
Look, yeah. Ford's building so much around the EcoBoost, and people got to remember that thing won the 24 hours of Daytona, and it actually did really well in the 12 hours of Sebring, too, although it didn't win that race.
Yeah.
So, hey, Craig Metros, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours. This has been really cool.
It's been great.
Can't wait to drive that thing.
Yeah, me too.
So,
have you driven it?
Not yet.
See, that makes me feel better.
There you go.
That makes me feel a whole lot better that you haven't driven it because, man, I'm dying to drive that thing. But once again, so awesome having you on the show.
Yeah, it's great.
We'll have you back when the car's out. And
sounds great.
We'll talk more about it then.
Have to come to Le Mans.
Better still.
It's a good way to get an early drive. Yeah.
There is no royal blood in this country. Nothing is reserved for anyone. It's all just out there, waiting for someone to reach out and take it. And the ones who do, these are the kings and queens of America.
I like, was that an invitation for us to go to Le Mans?
Yeah, I think all three of us. I'm confident
that's
because
right.
we were here and he didn't specify that it would be John, but.
Did you guys see this year's race?
I saw parts.
I saw about 8 hours of it.
Really?
Yeah. I was watching online, which is a great way to do it. Mm-hmm. But I missed the start. It was hard because the online coverage was not complete, 24-hour flag to flag. And then there was some stuff on TV, but you had to jump from, I think it was one Fox station to another Fox station. And it was a pain in the neck to try to find this thing. But
it's a shame with all the sports channels we have at our disposal these days that there's not one of them that can find the time to run it completely and, without having to jump to another channel. That's too bad.
Do you think it says something, though, about the nature of that sort of racing versus NASCAR or IndyCar?
Sure. Yeah, and certainly in the U.S. I would imagine that was, I think it's available all 24 hours long in Europe, I would think, on one of their sports channels.
Right.
So, but it does say something about, the nature of the sport.
But Porsche, holy moly!
Yeah, how are they feeling in Ingolstadt today? Are they on Monday? Or were they ready to jump off?
I don't know.
Some bridge.
It's all in the family, and Audi has been dominating for so long.
Five consecutive wins, and then
It, it's all in the family, and probably in Wolfsburg, they're very pleased.
Yeah.
Audi does not want to lose, and especially doesn't want to lose to Porsche.
Oh, no, of course not.
So, you know, kudos to Porsche. You know, what an accomplishment.
Yeah, second year back, and they win.
And they win, and not only that, you know, the closest Audi, I think, was three laps behind. Now, they had run into some problems. Toyota was, what, sixth place? I think they were seven laps behind. Mm-hmm. Nissan wasn't even in the running, really. And, you know, that was kind of a last-minute effort, so I kind of understand, you know.
Well, and I hate to sound Machiavellian about it, and certainly Audi wanted to win again, but you do have a problem in any sport with dynasties, with teams that just keep winning and winning and winning. And you had, you know, Schumacher win so many championships within a few years, and
you had
Vettel in F1 just do the same thing.
It gets boring.
Someone at the FIA, which runs Le Mans as well, must have been saying, gee, do we really need another Audi win? Only Audi thought it needed another Audi win, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And in, we were talking earlier about GTE Pro, Corvette won. And that was a hell of a battle for most of the race. Aston Martin did really, really well. Then they fell by the wayside. But pretty impressive to see Corvette go back and win that thing.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it really interesting for next year, because now you'll have, instead of Ferrari being the brand to try to slay, it'll be Chevrolet. It'll be the direct competitor to the Ford GT, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not the direct competitor in terms of the road car, but I mean in terms of the company involved.
So do you think that the guys over in Warren are doing something right now? They're thinking to themselves, "Damn, you know, we got to really up our game, because the guys at Ford have specifically built this car to go back for their 50th anniversary, and we're sort of building. We built the Corvette to
maybe
be
we'll
a Corvette.
See that mid-engine Zora Chevy Corvette or Cadillac or whatever it is before we know it.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems to me they would really have to do something to make themselves even more competitive, don't you think?
Well, you know, the guy who called in the question part, you know, the rapid fire part, that's a good question. You know, Corvette is a full blown production car. They make, I don't know, 40,000 a year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
This Ford GT is going to be extremely limited production, $400,000 car. And, you know, you've seen the thing. I mean, this thing was designed for the racetrack from the get-go. The Corvette was not. The Corvette's designed to be
a
road car, albeit with input from Corvette Racing. But, yeah, it's you got a good point there, Gary. What are they going to do?
Through May, 15,500 Corvettes have been delivered. So,
and that's just in U.S. numbers.
Right.
So there's a few more overseas as well.
Yeah, so that's just, you know.
Well, and Ford on this car is essentially farming out the assembly. And if you look at the last GT, the one from 2003 to 2005, whenever it was out, that was, even though that car had a sticker under $200,000, it sold in very small numbers, even for that price, I think.
And, yeah, I think it started out at $150,000. Good luck trying to buy one for that price. I think they've doubled in value.
Right.
It was without tires, steering wheel, seats. You know, those were all optioned up.
Yep. That would be Porsche that would do that.
Yeah. So, Gary, what else should we be talking about today?
Well, I know that this is a controversial subject with you, John. The J.D. Power IQS came out, speaking of Porsche, which 3 years in a row
is at the top
has
list.
Come out on top of the list. And the big surprise that the number two company this year is Kia.
Right.
And
that's impressive for Kia.
So
Hyundai was fourth, I think.
Hyundai was fourth.
And
Jaguar had been second last year. So basically,
I think Jaguar being second and now third is controversial enough. I mean, great cars, but, for them to reach that number is pretty impressive. And
mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting.
All right, so here's the thing that I was thinking about with regard to, so if you look at the top five, right? So you've got Porsche on top, you've got Kia number two, You've got Jaguar number three, and then Infiniti number five. Okay, so you have these cars. So I checked it out, and last year, Porsche in the United States share of the market was 0.3%. Mm-hmm. Jaguars was 0.1%, and Infiniti's was 0.7%. Now, do you sort of think that if you're making cars at that low, you know, volume, that you could really afford to have really high quality? I mean,
I don't think it's that so much. I don't recall. Were you at the APA yesterday when they announced results? I was there, and I asked the question of Ms. Stevens, Renee Stevens, who gave the presentation. She's from J.D. Power. Well, so the biggest area for complaints is basically voice recognition. Mm-hmm. And
what if your car doesn't have voice recognition?
Well, think about that. So
you're
Porsche
gonna do really well.
So Porsche, if you have a Cayenne, if you have a Macan, if you have a Panamera, you probably have voice recognition. You might have it in your Porsche 911. You might have it in your Boxster or your Cayman. Think about the Boxster, which, by the way, had the best score in its class. The Mazda Miata, for the sixth year in a row, had the best score in its class, even though Mazda as a brand didn't do quite so well. And, you know, as some viewers might know, my wife and I own a Mazda MX-5 Miata. And, you know, A, we don't have voice recognition. B, when you're driving it with the top down as often as possible, you wouldn't use the voice recognition anyway. So the nature of those cars, the nature of sports cars like the Porsches, like the Mazda MX-5 Miata, like some of the other sports cars in there, would be maybe more engagement with the steering wheel and the pedals and
so
the
more
gearbox,
mechanical, less
with the infotainment system.
Right.
You can barely hear the radio at the right speed anyway. So you don't even care about something as basic as the radio, let alone voice recognition.
It must be said that the Mazda was in the compact sporty car category. I like that.
That's
sporty car category.
Well, so was the Boxster was in the compact premium sporty car category.
So what I found to be funny is that the Miata beat the Volkswagen Eos and the Scion TC.
Right.
When's the last time you saw anybody with an Eos?
Not around here.
I saw one on the road, really?
Detroit.
And I was like, oh, an Eos.
Yeah.
I mean, they're so rare to see.
Oh, there goes a unicorn.
Yeah, right.
And well, better yet. So first of all, J.D. Power won't score it if they don't have a big enough sample size of a certain model. Secondly, take a look which model won in the minivan category.
Yeah, that was that struck me as well. The Nissan Quest.
I didn't know they still made those. Let alone being a unicorn.
And what surprised me was the Kia Sedona came in third.
Yes.
And that was the last Sedona. So.
Well, same with the Miata. It's the outgoing Miata.
Right, but I mean, the outgoing Miata was a...
Well, remember,
was,
all this data was a, was is from a year car. Ago. Mm-hmm. You know, or from cars that came out a year ago. And then it's the first 3 months of ownership of those cars.
Right.
New model year 2015 cars.
Yeah, 2015 model year, not calendar year.
Yes.
But, hey, we're going to take another quick break here. But, yeah, let's talk more about these quality rankings, because there's one I really want to point out.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter, the countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
Okay, back to the J.D. Power initial quality survey results. Much was made of how poorly Chrysler did, Chrysler Group, including Fiat.
And Chrysler
but
itself,
but Ram
third
did
from last.
Pretty well, right? Didn't Ram score above average?
Ram was, industry average is 100 12 problems per 100 vehicles. Okay, so 112. Ram was at 110.
Not so above average.
Above average.
And didn't Dodge do reasonably well?
116.
Well, and the Chrysler 300 was best in its segment.
Chrysler was bad.
With the 300, Chrysler was at the very bottom as a brand, but the Chrysler 300, they scored only 66.
They were best in the five.
Let's be fair to Chrysler here.
Yes.
They were not the last.
Not the last.
Fiat was the last.
And Smart was between Chrysler and Fiat.
Right.
So.
But the one that I wanted to point out that I find so interesting is Subaru. It was right down there in the bottom.
Yeah, Subaru is fourth from the bottom. Subaru just nudged out Chrysler with 142 problems per 100.
And nobody's
vehicles.
Saying anything about this. Everybody's jumping all over Fiat.
Everybody loves a Subaru. Come
I know,
on, Subaru's love.
Crazy. They're the fastest growing brand.
And again, the J.D. Power IQS is now placing more emphasis than ever, I think, on the quality of the design, more so than the quality of, you know, whether you have a defect that causes you to bring the car in that day or have it in the shop for several days. So a lot of it has to do with your infotainment system. Let's call it information entertainment system. How about that? And, you know, the touch screen and the, you know, Cadillac scored very poorly, and of course, Q had to have a lot to do with that, with the voice recognition, about who the buyers are even. Someone asked the question about whether Kia might have, because they have value-priced cars, whether its buyers might be less critical of the cars. And the answer was, well, their buyers tend to be younger, and the younger buyers tend to be pretty critical. So,
well, and there's another way of looking at that. If you're a purchaser of a Porsche or a Jaguar, and you spent a lot of money on this vehicle, you might be more willing to say to yourself, "I don't think I want to complain so much about that because I've made this commitment." And it goes both ways, absolutely. But I mean, in terms of infotainment system, I mean, we talked last week on the show about, you know, Chevrolet is making, you know, greater commitment to you know, infotainment and and, you know, digitalization of their vehicles, and you know, they came in seventh. I mean, they came in
pretty good.
They became, you know, BMW, Chevy, then Lincoln, then Lexus. I mean, so here's a case where you have a mass market brand, has a lot of products, therefore there are a lot of things people can complain about, right? And yet they came in so high. But I mean, that's the thing that surprises me most about Kia is the fact that, you know, they're a full line manufacturer, you know, with the exception of pickup trucks,
yeah.
Right? They've got one of everything, you know, so it goes from an Accent to the K900.
And their second best selling model consistently is the Soul, which is a
right.
And the
Soul won its category, and it was the only one in that category.
Now again, going back to that young buyer,
Bizarro World MPV category that they were in.
Going back to that young buyer, any problems, defects with the ability to drive the car aside. If a lot of the problems are related to entertainment information systems and voice activation, you have young buyers, they may be more savvy about using that technology. I think we're certainly seeing that kind of technology, the kind of technology fueled by, you know, Microsoft and Google and Apple getting into the car and being certainly less confusing for, say, my niece and nephew versus myself. So,
I find these numbers interesting. I dare say, though, if you plotted sales gain or loss or market share gain or loss, you would see no pattern that relates to these quality ratings. And so, if I were a manufacturer, I'd pay close attention to the numbers, but I'm not sure the marketplace really pays any attention at all.
Although, if I were a manufacturer, I'd certainly be making my advertisements and having those nice trophies in there. And if I were a trophy manufacturer, I would be knocking on the doors with these guys and saying, you know, I'll make you some really cool trophies.
And not to take their side, I tend to agree with you. You know, J.D. Power says that they do make a difference. But obviously, they're selling these data to the automakers, and they give them much more detailed information on how those, I think it was 85,000 new car buyers scored their cars in that short time period.
But I just wonder if this isn't like really a lagging indicator. So all of the guys then begin chasing like, oh, we've got to make better armrests, or we've got to make different cup holders. And
well, they do then have to make better voice recognition.
And then by power,
I do agree with that. It's atrocious.
And then they by the time they get all these things done, then you know, people are more interested in the headliners or in the steering wheel materials or something like that.
Okay, Gary, what else
you
got?
All right, so we're going to do one of our so we're talking about numbers and we're talking about statistics here. And now, okay, so you guys get in and out of a lot of cars, and you look at a lot of Monroney's, and on the Monroney's you always see those you know, the EPA sticker numbers for fuel efficiency. So what's your sense of those stickers? Are they accurate, inaccurate? Do you have a sense that when you get in them, it's like, ah, I give it a 10% margin of error?
Well, it's always, you know, it's always to be used as a comparison with other cars, with other models in its category. Obviously, when you work for a car magazine, you don't drive cars slowly. You may not drive them in the way that would get the best fuel mileage. So on comparisons, we do take fuel mileage numbers. We take a look at real world numbers. You know, sometimes they're seldom what the EPA says. That said, I can think back to my my first brand new car was a 1987 Honda CRX, and it was just the straight CRX with a 5-speed manual, no air conditioning, and I consistently got as good as the EPA, or sometimes better, and I drove it, you know, pretty fast. And then since the 87 model year, the EPA has adjusted those numbers down. They've actually made adjustments to the numbers that they put out and took a big chunk out of them. And so if you look, you can now look back at historic EPA numbers and see both the original sticker numbers and the numbers adjusted down to. So, you know, in some cases, you know, maybe if you could buy a car without air conditioning, you might be able to reach those numbers.
So what's your sense, John?
I think the EPA number is accurate if you look at the combined number. And what I'm talking about is for the average driver. And I'm talking about average drivers who don't live in the mountains or in very hilly areas or at high altitude, because those will skew the numbers. But I think the EPA...
And they don't drive like Todd.
Right, exactly.
Wait,
right.
I'm not the only one here.
I'm just saying.
I'm talking about the average person. I'm the average driver. So I think they're relatively accurate.
Yeah, okay. So AAA heard that there were a lot of people who were complaining about these numbers, and so they did an analysis of sticker number accuracy. And so they had 37,000 self-reported statistics of how people did with their vehicles, okay? So now, as a result of these reports, they came out with some categories. So people with manual transmission vehicles, better than or less than the EPA sticker, what do you think?
I know the answer.
I would say less than.
So manual transmission, less than.
Except when I'm running out of gas. And
normal people, no, these 37,000 people.
No, they beat it, and so they beat it handily.
They beat it 17%. Then the
explains the
look,
CRX.
People who buy manual transmissions are better drivers, just by definition.
Okay. I also think people who self-report are more keen.
Prone to lie.
No, more keen on getting better miles per gallon than people who say, "Ah, screw it, we don't pay attention to that." All right. Diesel-powered vehicles.
Oh, I know the answer to that.
Better or worse?
Better than the EPA number.
Right.
Significantly better or just better?
Significantly.
And very significantly, 20% better than with the
EPA. In fact, you know, Volkswagen Group, both Volkswagen and Audi, have complained to the EPA that their test methodology penalizes diesels because they have way too much emphasis on the city number versus the highway, and diesels just shine on the highway.
And that makes a great point. I remember driving the 2012 VW Passat turbo diesel on several long drives and getting better than 50 miles per gallon, or about 50 miles per gallon. I think the number is 42 highway. But that gets back to your point about how the combined number should be reported more often. Automakers take the highway number, and they always advertise that. So the average car buyer, you know, might go to the EPA website and look up the fuel mileage numbers for the two or three cars he or she is looking to buy. But when most of them just look at the ads and the ads say 40 mpg highway, or they just say 40 mpg highway, that's where people get frustrated that they'll never get that number.
All right, a couple. Okay, trucks with gasoline V8s, better than the sticker or less than the sticker?
Less than the sticker, I would say.
I know the answer. Uh-huh. They got better.
5% better.
Really? Wow.
All right. Now, here we really getting controversial. Trucks with turbocharged V6s, better than the sticker or less than the sticker?
I know what our experience is, and it's less than the sticker.
And your experience at automobile shows?
Quite a bit less than sticker. Hard to get the EPA number on. Shall we name names?
There's one.
There's one, yeah.
It's called EcoBoost.
It's the Ford F-150 EcoBoost.
Right.
And we're talking about the 3.5. I haven't driven the 2.7 extensively yet.
No, I have not driven the 2.7 extensively.
Although I have driven it, and I got nowhere near the number.
Right, so they found it was 9% less than expected. Sedans with V6s.
I would say they probably get less than the EPA number.
They got better.
Really?
9% better.
Wow. So almost everybody got better than the EPA number.
Well, there's one more category.
One more category.
I said almost.
Sedans with turbocharged I4s.
So apparently there's a problem with turbocharging, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, there is.
Maybe there is no.
So what do you think, Todd?
For displacement. Well, I'm going to say that was less than the EPA number.
4% below.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm trying to remember who we had talking about this on the show one time, who was basically saying that those engines really have to work harder, and as they're working harder, they're putting more gas.
Yeah, it's if you look at the EPA label, there's not any real heavy acceleration. And so a downsized turbocharged engine will shine on the EPA test. But if you get out there and, you know, what the people from Ford especially will tell you is, oh, you love that power. You love to get into the turbo. And my argument is, no, I'm just trying to keep up with traffic. And the way those engines are designed, you get into the turbo very, very easily. And so if you want to keep up with traffic, you're into the turbo. And now all of a sudden you're not getting the great fuel economy.
So for EPA, a turbo lag is good to be able to, in regular driving, ease into it and not get into the turbo until later in your stoplight.
Exactly right. The only time where turbos really shine is with diesels. Diesels love turbochargers.
Yeah,
it really enhances the fuel economy.
What does this say about the fact that almost everybody's looking at turbos now? Honda, you know, for its Civic will go to a full turbo line. Chevy in many of its applications, the four-cylinder applications.
They'll
get the EPA number. They'll reach CAFE, but we really won't save as much.
So it won't be like your CRX.
CAFE, no, it won't, yeah.
And look, I love turbos. I mean, I love the way they drive, and, you know, even better still is combining a supercharger with a turbo like Volvo's doing in the XC90.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's awesome. It really, really works. But from a fuel efficiency standpoint, not as good as a naturally aspirated.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I would go on to say, as I keep pointing out, though as an enthusiast, I'm not always all that keen on them, but CVTs, continuously variable transmissions, deliver real-world fuel economy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the latest generation of them, especially from Nissan, you know, they've been the most assiduous at trying to get these things to work right. They're damn good.
They're getting better. They're still hard to like, but they're getting better.
I think you can fool most of the people most of the time with these, you know, pseudo shift, you know, where they've programmed in a kind of shift to go with it.
Could I make a plug for my? We've been talking about autonomy most every time I've been on this show, and a big takeout piece that I've done for the August issue of the magazine will be coming out at the end of this month, and it'll be online on Monday at automobilemag.com. So,
on autonomy,
I take the view that that it's coming, and here's why. And Preston Lerner, one of our contributors, takes the opposite a point of view and saying, here are all the barriers to it.
But oh, cool.
I think we've done a pretty complete job.
When will a car drive me home from the studio?
Not today.
No.
I can't wait to read that, Todd, because, you know, as you know, I've been following this autonomous stuff for a long time. I'd really be interested to see what you guys have to say about it, pro and con.
Yeah, yeah.
Next week, maybe?
Well, it'll be online.
No.
Oh, your car.
Yes,
next week.
Okay.
Sure. We'll send you a car, okay? Call up Google and have them do that.
Hey, the control room saying we got another phone call here. Let's bring that in.
Hi, this question is for Todd Lassa. He brought up his Mazda Miata that him and his wife enjoy.
It's Jonathan.
How does he like that model that he owns? I'm assuming an NC?
Yes, it's an NC.
The new one, the ND.
Ah, good question.
Is he planning on buying one? Does he like it better?
I'll tell you.
His version that he owns?
Well, I'll tell you, I like it a lot because of the lightweight. I like our car a lot. It's a good Four Seasons car with the folding hardtop, and when we put Blizzax on it in the winter, and it's a 6-speed manual. I do like the new one a lot. My wife is still warming up to it, frankly.
Oh, really? What is she not so keen on?
Well, part of it's the styling. I think she thinks that they've tried to get too butch, if you will, with the styling. And I would say the styling isn't the big thing I like about the ND either. I think it's not bad, but it looks sporty and it looks like a Miata.
It's not as huggable as the version you've got.
It's not as huggable. I described it first time I saw it it's kind of like when MG went from the TCs and the TDs and the TFs to the MGA. It's kind of like going from that kind of spindly sports car look to a little more of a hunkered down kind of look, and it certainly makes it look a little bit more butch. And my wife's coming around a little bit. We had a ride in one last weekend, she liked a lot of things about it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
I would also like them to offer the sport suspension in the Grand Touring model. You can either get the Club Sport with the sport suspension, or you get the Grand Touring model, but not with the sport suspension. I think that's a mistake.
Something for them to add going forward.
Well, perhaps.
Yeah. If enough people complain,
yes,
they will make it so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Hey, we're at the top of the hour. Time to wrap it up. But Todd, great having you back.
Thanks to be here, John.
For that brilliant Miata insight.
All right. Especially. Thanks for letting me be here.
Yeah.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Gary, let's do this again next week.
We'll do that.
And we invite all of you to join us then.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Chrysler. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.